This episode of Desert Island Dishes is brought to you in partnership with the independent, family-run butcher, H.G. Walter. Now, I'm particularly excited about this because for over 10 years, I have been a customer of H.G. Walter for both my cooking jobs and also for at home too. They are one of the most respected butchers in the UK, supplying some of the best chefs and restaurants in the country. So it's quite cool to know that you are getting restaurant quality meat at home. And I know I've said this a million times before, but if you start with good ingredients, your life as a cook is so much easier. You barely have to do anything for it to taste delicious. And we know that good quality meat is more important than ever. If you're anything like me, you are thinking more and more about the provenance of the food you eat. And so having a butcher you can trust like H.G. Walter is just a very comforting thing. Also, never underestimate the knowledge of a butcher. If you don't know how to cook something, ask when you're in there. They know so much, they can advise about cooking times, the weight you need, and they'll always have delicious ideas for how they like to serve something. I found this kind of information absolutely invaluable when I was starting out as a chef, so I am thrilled to be telling you all about H.G. Walter today. They're based in London, but they deliver nationwide, and you can find out more at www.hgwalter.com. Thank you very much. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their seven desert island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, I hope you're all very well. Now, I know I told you that this was just going to be a short little season for the month of February, but already we've come to the end and it's gone very quickly. So fear not, we are already recording the next, so hopefully it won't be too long to wait. I went to Sri Lanka last year for the very first time and completely fell in love. I've been to Hoppers many times. I kind of knew what to expect in terms of the food, but honestly, it's just the most amazing country with the most incredibly delicious food. So it really was brilliant to hear from Curran about his love for it too, and how he turned that love and admiration into a concept for one of the most successful restaurant groups in London. Before I leave you with today's episode, this is just a gentle reminder to anyone listening. If you haven't yet subscribed to my newsletter, Dinner Tonight, please do think about it. It's one easy weeknight recipe, often one pan, mostly 30 minutes or less, and I genuinely look forward to writing it so much every week. It's just incredible that there are so many people reading it. There are now over 22,000 of you, which is just amazing. But there is always room for more. Anyway, I do hope you enjoyed today's episode and thank you so much for listening. My guest today is Curran Gokhani. Curran is the founder and creative director of the restaurant group Hoppers, which celebrates the food of Sri Lanka and southern India. He grew up in Mumbai, where his love of home-cooked Indian food started at a very young age, and his enthusiasm for food never wavered as he ultimately gave up his career in law to pursue his passion. But we all know that a passion for food doesn't necessarily mean someone is suited to a career as a professional chef and the confines of the kitchen, and Curran spent time in restaurants both in the kitchen and front of house before ultimately opening his own restaurant, the famous Hoppers. Hoppers celebrates the incredible food of Sri Lanka, a cuisine that Londoners knew much less about in 2015, and they now have three Hoppers restaurants, and he's topped the Sunday Times bestseller list with his cookbook. Welcome, Curran.
Thank you for having me here, Margie. Like we were saying earlier, I think I've got a very privileged bottom sitting on this chair, which has recorded so many more illustrious people, you know, ranging from every sort of background. And I love your podcast. Love what you do.
That's so nice.
I've binged on it in the last 2 days just to give myself some answers.
I'm honoured to have
very
you
nervous.
On. No.
No, I'm not. Please don't. I'm not. I'm just joking. Nervous about a couple of questions, which I might try and dodge.
Yeah, some of them are tricky. No, but I'm delighted to have you on Desert Island Dishes. And as you all know, at the end, we are going to feed you something delicious and then send you off to a desert island. How do you feel about that?
I mean, on a day like today, anything that has sun would be fantastic. I've been soaked twice cycling around London. Yeah. Eventually ditched my cycle, borrowed my manager's umbrella, came walking over. Still got wet, soggy socks.
Yeah.
So any desert, beautiful. Anywhere in the world, island, no island, very happy to go there.
Are you good in your own company?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so you'd be trying to get off the island.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Or I'll find something to cook on it.
Yes.
I'll start foraging. And
you have become synonymous with the food of Sri Lanka, but you grew up in Mumbai, which we'll talk about in a moment. Mm-hmm. How would you describe in a few words Sri Lankan cuisine? What defines it for you?
I think when I train my team, and we've got a lot of people who've never, you know, heard of Sri Lanka when they join the team, the first thing I say, when you think of an island, what do you think of first? So it's palm trees, fish, and then you add curry leaves to it, you add a ton of spices. For me, Sri Lanka was only this tiny little cricketing island off the coast of India when I grew up. But then I made my first friends at university, and it was amazing. It blew me away. The people, the diversity of the island, and obviously the food. Mm. But I actually think the food came third. I fell in love with the people first and how much you can do in this wonderful place and just how welcomed I felt then. Obviously today that's grown exponentially and just felt we needed to do something. So well before the restaurants were even conceived, I proposed to my now wife there. And
that's amazing. You know, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so there is some sort of, I always joke, there's a cosmic connection with the country. I've got more friends in Colombo today than I have in any city in the world, despite never having lived there.
Wow.
But now to answer your question, the food, it's it is also very varied. In the north, you've got the influences of South India, Tamil Nadu, Tamil influences, but still done differently. So heavy on spice, not as much coconut as the south. And then you go down south, I find that it's very similar to food from Kerala, which is the southern west coast of India, but with influences from East Asia, which I love. So, you know, Malaysian influences, things like pandan leaves, lemongrass in food, along those beautiful aromatics, along with stuff that we are quite, you know, well-versed with in India. So I felt it was familiar, but yet so different. And then you have, you know, Dutch burger food, which is almost like the Anglo-Indian food in India, but you've got the sort of Dutch influence with local Sri Lankans. You have a dish called lump rice, which is just unbelievable.
So do you remember the first time you went to Sri Lanka?
I remember very clearly the first time I went to Sri Lanka.
How old were you?
It wasn't that long ago. It must have been about 16 years ago now. 16 years ago. Yeah, it was just after the war. I'd made my first very close Sri Lankan friends at university. Actually, only at that point, Sri Lankan friends at university. Went to visit all of them in summer between sort of university and starting a job here in London, a job as a lawyer. And the irony of it was we had this whole trip around the island planned. It was so hot when we got there. Cancelled all of it and just stayed at home at my friend's house and cooked with her mother for the entire week.
Sri Lanka more than anywhere else, when you talk about it, people do mention the people. It's always the food and it's always
phenomenal.
The people.
Isn't it? They're just such, you know, for me, it's just one small test. As a non-Sri Lankan, I, you know, came out and we just wanted to have fun. We wanted to bring to central London a cuisine that we missed. So that's a very fundamental thing to what, you know, we do in the family. My wife and her brothers have a group of restaurants. I plugged into them to open Hoppers. And I'd go as far as saying, even with the other restaurants in the group, it's just one clear motive. It's not trying to fill a gap in the market or thinking of it too commercially. It is, obviously that's important, but it's very much, what's a cuisine we feel is missing? We would go out to eat every night and we find lacking in London. And Sri Lankan and South Indian, I always use the two in the same breath because we have a lot of South Indian food. Majority of my team is from Kerala and Tamil Nadu. So there's a lot of that food as well. We just miss that. And we brought them together. They work beautifully well together. And I can't think of any other country in the world where you'd be welcomed, cheered, and honored for representing them. Sri Lankans have been so generous in accepting me, helping, you know, push Hoppers forward. I feel so blessed every time I go to Sri Lanka and make more and more friends. So, you know, for me, that's become a big why of what I do today. Sort of for me, it's not about just creating restaurants and feeding people. It's about how many restaurateurs can really say you fly the flag for a country.
Yes,
and
amazing.
I think we've started doing that to an extent.
Okay, let's dive into the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
It's got to be a dish I still eat almost every day, a dosa. Ooh. Have you eaten a dosa?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
for those who haven't, it's a lentil and rice sort of pancake, for want of a better term. Very, very thin, crispy crepe. You ferment the two. They get a lot of slightly sour, bubbly. You grind them with some fenugreek seeds. And then you make it into a really thin batter. You allow that to sort of bubble up a little bit. There's no yeast, no leavening agent. And then with the back of a bowl, you put it onto a hot plancher with a little bit of ghee or butter, and then it just sizzles. And you get it as thin as possible, rolling this, is, you know, like swirling that bowl as quickly as possible, and then you kind of roll it up and it's crispy. Sometimes I love a chili cheese version. It's a little bit of cheddar, mozzarella, body powder, green chilies.
Is that and how then, you would have had it growing
no,
up?
No, so as a kid, we just it's so funny because, you know, although you're away in Bombay, which is technically the West, mm. you have so many influences from all over the country. So it's, I think, the biggest melting pot in India. Mm. And I mean, there's this culture amongst, you know, friends and a lot of people, families in Bombay, where Sunday is dosa day. So it's sort of, you have batter, which either you make at home or you can buy now very easily, or you have in the freezer, so it freezes really well. And you make it, and you just, you're literally, there's you know, most people have a cook at home, or it might be a mother or father or someone making it. And you just roll these out, and you have little chutneys on the side or sambar, and then you have a potato stuffing in the middle. So there it's eaten quite simply. But as a kid, I remember we did sort of freestyle a little bit, go and add cheese. And wow. stuff to it. And obviously now that we've grown up, green chilies and everything is great. So so there's something about that.
Yeah. You say that your passion for food began at a very early age and that you were often to be found in the kitchen with your family's cook rolling chapatis.
Yeah, yeah.
Of that time, you say that you really enjoyed the process of getting your hands dirty. But I wondered, were you a voracious eater? Like, was it about the food or was it about the cooking?
I'm glad you asked that. So I was just on a panel the other day and there were a few questions. We were talking about a new food film that's just come out. And for me, I've sat on so many panels or like done interviews where I ask a chef a simple question. I said, if there was a dish, would you rather eat it or cook it? I think a lot of people stumble and think, it's like, I'm not sure. Actually, it depends on the dish and this and that. For me, it was a very, very clear answer always. I'd rather cook it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you'd rather eat it. 100%.
No, no, no.
I would 100% rather
eating
eat
for
it.
Me is sometimes sort of a reverse engineering process. Mm. And I love that whole kinesthetic thing of bringing ingredients together and creating something brand new and then often seeing the joy on someone's face. I've just actually had a meeting with someone, which I do almost 3 times a week. I don't have an office, so I sit at one of the restaurants, call people and put them on the spot, make them eat a full meal. I love watching people eat. And people tend to start feeling awkward. They're like, no, aren't you eating? I said, no, no, no. I'll happily watch you, especially at my restaurant. I'll happily watch you eat because your eyes don't lie if you like something.
Yeah.
And I'll make sure I feed them something they will like.
That's so interesting. So it has always been about
so I think it was always that kinesthetic thing about like creating things, whether it was craft, whether it's sort of, you know, dabbling with paint or clay or...
Because I was going to ask that. Obviously, cooking sparks creativity and it's this artistic expression. But then obviously you went on to become a lawyer and lawyers yeah. are very analytical and probably in danger of insulting all lawyers. But I wondered whether that's typical of a lawyer to be creative in that way and artistic.
I don't know. I don't want to speak for all lawyers. Yeah. I think there were a lot of creative people around in a different way.
Yeah.
But it's definitely the different side of the brain that sort of gets you more...
Although I guess
consistent
it's
with what you do, more rote.
There's a connection between music and maths, isn't there? So maybe actually, yeah. you know, obviously music's very artistic. So maybe I've answered my own question there.
No, I think there were a lot of creative people. I was just fortunate enough to find my exit at the right time or like to actually walk out the door at the right time rather than finding an exit. There is always an exit.
Yeah.
But more importantly, walking out without really thinking too much about that safety blanket. So really throwing myself at this. And also very fortunate to be surrounded by the right people, whether it's my wife and her family or my parents who are very supportive or all the people who've sort of embraced me.
Let's talk about the second Desert Island dish. And that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
Well, it was the first dish. I'd be lying if I made one up. But I did roll a lot of chapatis, which are those sort of balloony kind of breads, which I still love and still get nervous cooking because there's no guarantee they turn out right.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as many bread series as I've done on Instagram, as much as bread as I've cooked, there's still that little bit of anxiety when doing it.
Okay.
I'd never do it on live TV. So Saturday Kitchen, I wouldn't do this.
Okay.
I wouldn't
do that at a Saturday Kitchen dish.
But it was funny. My aunt, at that point, my mom's sister had gone off to, had actually come to London and done a course over summer at the Cordon Bleu. And that time, that was a big thing. This is back in the 90s, and I must have been all of 5 years old or something. And everyone was very enamored by, you know, all the cakes and things she cooked when she came back, and meringues and macarons and stuff like that. And she very, I think maybe to keep us out of her kitchen, went and brought us a little series of Ladybird books. the little sort of hardback, typical sort of old school Ladybird books. And I've actually still got a couple of them.
They're actually very good.
But there were five of them. And it just made England, I'd never been to England then, just made England seem like this unbelievable place where children just sit and cook. And I was sitting in here like, you know, again, there was a bit of, you know, my family has been very supportive. But back in the day, it's always been a little bit like, you know, males don't necessarily enter the kitchen. And now that's changed hugely. And there's another story in my life.
Domestically, has that changed?
I think it's cooking has become very sexy all over the world. Mm. And I think, you know, you have programs like MasterChef and others to thank for that. The whole competitive TV of cooking. But back in the day, there was a little thing. But more than that, I just make a mess. Yeah. So there were these books, and I remember recipes for like fruit fools, and it just sounded like, what the hell is all this? And the best bit is, you know, you had things like plain flour, bread flour, plain flour, baking powder, baking. In India, you had none of that. Mm. So finally, I think I must have found like one recipe. It was probably a fool, which was just cream and a fruit and a little bit of sugar and egg whites or something. And I just go and make that every day in the afternoon because I had access to them. There was no cooking ingredients. The minute everyone would go off for their siesta in the afternoon, slip in the kitchen, make a complete mess with egg whites at like the age of 6 or 7 or whatever, 6 maybe. And then I'd hate eating any of that because it'll just be like flopped egg whites blended with some fruit or something. So that was probably the first thing I made.
Yeah. Did you ever do that test where you put the bowl over your head to see whether the egg whites are
No, unfortunately,
enough?
No. There wasn't a step in the book, but it would have gone horribly wrong.
That was a lucky escape. So I read that you spent your summer holidays when you were studying law in Mumbai working in hotel kitchens, and you actually realised quite quickly that you didn't want to be in the kitchen itself. And you say that that was because it didn't suit your personality. What did you mean about that specifically?
I loved the food. I loved the creative process. For me, that's still the starting point of everything. And, you know, I have so much respect for chefs who can go in and do it day in and day out.
Yeah.
But at that point, I didn't realize, but I kind of just felt I wanted to do more than be in a kitchen because I love people.
Mm.
And I love that interaction both with the front of house, with guests, with networking. I don't even call it networking. I was like making friends.
Yes.
Just making friends and, you know, doing bigger things.
I know you've talked about the expectation that your parents had for you to do maybe something traditional and stable. I know your father and brother are both doctors. Mm-hmm. Did
you know a lot? Gosh, wait. I'm scared now. No. Slowly unraveling. Yeah.
But did you ever think that you would eventually do something creative, or did you feel like you did have to do something traditional?
I think I did both in the end. Mm. I followed that traditional path, and you know that was the more sort of, I'd say, discipline me going off and saying, okay, fine.
Because of the expectation.
And I guess the culture I grew up in.
Yeah.
Unless you had a business to fall back on, unless you had this thing, you wouldn't necessarily get entrepreneurial. Today, things are different, you know, 20 years on. But when I was in school, it was very much like, okay, fine, what are you doing next?
Like aged 18, if you'd said to your parents, I think I want to do something in the world of food, how would that have gone down?
Dad is great. He's always been very rational. He has always been very supportive, but I guess his advice would have been the same as it was at age 25, 26, when I actually made the career shift, 27. That, look, do it. I'll support you all heartily, but make sure you are completely sure you want to do it and there's no turning back from here.
Yeah. And is that advice now that you'd give your children?
Yeah, I'd support them in doing whatever they like to do. You know, obviously you want to make sure that they've sort of assessed their options and looked around before making. And I think the one advice I give to anyone is that in those years when you have those long university breaks, if people are still going to university in the next sort of 10 years, who knows? But like if you've got those long summers, just go off and make a completely crazy wish list of alternative careers you could be in. And honestly, make that list. And the one thing you have is time. And, you know, people often get scared. They're like, oh, why would someone hire me? I was like, if you go to someone and say, I will volunteer my time, very likely no one's going to say no to you. And in future, 5 years from now, when you're hating a job, hopefully not, but when you're hating a job, it might just come to the front. And it'll give you a real world perspective rather than just through a TV show or a film.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened to me. Sort of, I did this, banked in, and said, okay, fine. I actually feel I'm on the right track. I continued law. And then it was only 10 years later, one day, that I kind of brought those memories back. I said, I loved those things about it. How do I make a career of it?
Mm.
Yeah.
I know you've been dreading this question, but we're on to the third Desert Island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
As someone in food, it's just such a hard question to... It's like asking me about my kids.
which one is your favorite? No, but honestly, which one
I mean,
one
every
is?
Morning is one. There's definitely one every morning.
One's I know. Parents definitely lie when they say that, don't they?
I'm going to be greedy and I'm not going to say a dish, but I'm going to say an experience. Mm. There's a restaurant in Bombay called Takkar Bhojanalaya, which I used to go to as a, like, you know, when I was a lot younger as well. Now it's become quite cool. They do something known as a thali. A thali is basically, it translates as a big plate. And then you have tiny little bowls. It's all vegetarian. It's from the western part of India, so Gujarat and Rajasthan. And it's just unlimited. So you spend, it's about £6 and all you can eat. Every day you'll have about, there's at least about 18 dishes in there. So I've kind of twisted that question. Yeah. It's not one dish, but for me, that experience, the hospitality, you have a whole army of people coming in with buckets, like little buckets, and feeding you and topping you up. So when you're done, you've literally got to stick your head down on that plate. And even then you run the risk of someone pouring, topping your head up with something.
And then you get carried out.
Because
you
just got to say no. You've got to lie down on top of the plate because if you leave a gap, they will find a way to top you up. And it is honestly, like, it's something that it's everything. It's hospitality. It's family cooking. It's family eating together. For me, that place is encapsulates everything hospitality food should be about. For me, a thali at Takkar Bhojanalaya is probably my dream meal, maybe not a dish.
That sounds like my kind of place. And that you grew up vegetarian, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we'd sneak meat into the house whenever you could. We'd sneak fish in from the neighbor's home whenever we could.
What, you and your siblings? So it was your parents?
My younger brother. My parents were complicit in it.
Okay.
It was more my grandparents who were sort of, my grandmother who lived with us. Sometimes she wasn't too keen on it. And then I think they had this thing of, we don't want to cook in the house, so... When you smell fried fish next door, I'd sneak off and get a piece. So those are also great, you know, very, very strong memories of those smells of fried fish with masala, pommes frites, great smells. Yeah,
so good. You came to university to study law at Cambridge. Had you been to the UK many times before then?
No, I'd been once.
Wow.
Been once on a family holiday.
Wow.
And had my cousin and aunts take us up to Oxford. So never even seen Cambridge.
Wow.
And, you know, show us this amazing... university and then I'd started doing university in Mumbai. I keep saying Bombay. It's not political at all. It's just that's the city I grew up in. So I did my first degree there and then very quickly realized I feel there's more. I could do something better. I could do it, you know, go to a better university, even just purely for the academics.
Okay. And how did you find coming to Britain for the first time?
Well, I loved coming here. I loved the freedom. I loved the supermarkets. We never had, even till today, Mumbai doesn't have supermarkets like you have over here on every corner. Like you've got to, if you want to plan a dinner party back home, you've got to plan a day in advance. You've got to go to a fishmonger separately. You've got to go off to a supermarket and get certain things. And you go to a dry store and get certain things. It's not that easy. Mm-hmm. And there's traffic to, you know, account for as well. Whereas here, if I decided at 9 a.m. I want to cook for friends off to the local Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, whatever it might, or even corner shop.
Yeah.
And then come back. Hell, I've gone to a Turkish store at 3 a.m. on Christmas Eve and managed to buy everything I need for Christmas Day. So, you know, that's the amazing thing about UK. When I was in Cambridge, I loved that. I actually started cooking meat there.
Okay.
At uni, I definitely cooked much more than I studied.
Yes.
Or spend time in any classroom or at my desk in my room.
Because I read about that. You were doing so much cooking. But I wondered in terms of the food that you were eating out or other people's food. Weren't. Okay.
Literally cooking. And I had 7 other boys to blame for the mess. We were 8 of us in this little dorm, big kitchen. I'd negotiated fridge space with everyone. We almost had like a tiny little fridge and it was 1/3 a shelf for everyone. And my... favorite times of the week or month were going out grocery shopping, having sort of 6 massive shopping bags hung around my handlebar, sort of balancing back from Mill Road, which was where all the Asian shops were. I remember my best friend at uni, he came to me on Diwali, which is like our New Year's. Mm. And he came to me, he's a very British horse. He's like, oh, Karen, I've got a great surprise for you. I said, yeah, what is it? He's like, I will take you to the big Tesco today as a celebration for Diwali, but you only have 1 hour. Because he knew I'd just go nuts. And I think I just got lost on purpose and spent about 2 hours shopping and then came back and negotiated with everyone on fridge space.
I feel like with British food, it is quite nuanced in a way. And there are dishes that seem very normal if you've grown up with them. But were there any surprises coming to England, like in your early 20s? Were you confronted by anything that you thought was really strange?
So I think I had to sing very politely now that I've sort of lived here and acquired some of the traits. It was quite bland, or sort of lacking spice, I'd say. Bland is not polite enough. To begin with, Whole Food wasn't the best representative of British food. But there was a turning point. There was this really interesting point. So 3 years, I'd go back to India to see family every time I could in every break. But then there was this 1 year, the same said friend invited me to his house for Christmas. His parents live in a lovely house in Burford, in the Cotswolds, so as idyllic as you can get. It's an old mill in this little town and really beautiful. So the first time ever I'm in England over Christmas, in London over Christmas, he says, come home for Christmas. I said, okay, great. I said, quid pro quo, I'll happily do you an Indian meal for Boxing Day. They said, yeah, fantastic. We're not going to say no to that. Mm. Little did I know they're going to invite about 20 people from the village as well. Actually, not the first year. After that, subsequently, every time I did that, there were more and more people there. And I went prepared for that. But this year, it was just the immediate family. So I pitch up on Christmas Eve, having taken the train, and his dad comes to pick me up. And I go with one little plastic bag that big, apart from my clothes. His mom's very politely. She's like, were you going to be cooking Boxing Day Indian for us? I said, yeah, yeah. She's like, you haven't asked me to buy anything. I said, no, just go off in the morning and buy stuff. It's like, nothing is open in this country.
Oh, no.
If you've not been here over Christmas, nothing is open. Fortunately, I bagged the last free-range organic chicken in the co-op, which was open. Otherwise, they wouldn't have touched it.
Oh, no.
And ever since, I've sort of ordered all my meat in and everything in. But for me, that was a real revelation as to how Christmas, everything shuts down. But the point of the story was, on that Christmas day, I was just blown away by the sort of the excitement for a very simple meal. I'm sorry to say, but you know, the traditional Christmas meal.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. And what I love now, being on the other side, sort of, you know, sometimes it's just about an excitement to put a meal on a table. And I love that. I just love that enthusiasm for a bird you won't touch the rest of the year. So, and for me, that was, you know, quintessential. I said, food doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need to go over the top. Like, we are so good at, you know, having 40 dishes on a menu and overfeeding people as Indians. So it can actually be fairly simple. And ever since, I have been madly in love with a good, solid roast dinner. Roast lunch. And here's the biggest irony. My wife, who is of Indian origin, grew up here, absolutely hates it.
What?
She will find any excuse to escape the house when I'm cooking roast. But I will still try my hardest to invite the right people and enjoy it.
That brings us on to the most important question of the day, the fourth desert island dish. What is your favorite sandwich?
It has been described as a sandwich in the past. It's called a vada pav. You probably had it? Heard of it?
I don't think I have.
So growing up in Bombay, it's typical street food. It's a potato, sort of, it's mashed, it's spiced potatoes. You kind of mash them, but not completely. And then you spice them up with things like coriander and like mustard seeds and turmeric and ginger and garlic and everything else. And lots of green chili. And then you roll them up into a bowl, coat them in gram flour batter. So chickpea batter, so vegan. And then deep fried. And then you have a garlic chutney, you have fried chili, and sometimes you have another sort of tamarind, sweet tamarind chutney, all in this little bun, which looks a little bit like a sort of like a bread roll, like a porterhouse roll, but the soft, somehow Indians have mastered the art of creating what we call a pav, B-A-V. That's an interesting one as well, because you sort of, the history is used to jump on it with your feet, and foot in India is pav.
Oh, wow.
Or in that language, in Maharashtra, is pav. So you used to jump on it with your feet, a bit like, you know, crushing grapes, stomping grapes. And that's how it was made bulk, you know, in bulk. And it's the poor man's, common man's bread. So it's, you see these guys in the evening, bread sellers, just selling soft. It's like billowy, the softest bread ever. I don't know how they make it. I've tried really hard. I've gotten close, but never made it. And they open that up and literally stuff that freshly fried bun inside, the potato dumpling inside, and the vada with all the chutneys. And, you know, that is one of the most popular, iconic street food dishes in Mumbai.
That sounds
so that would probably
amazing.
Be my sandwich if it wasn't a Pret Christmas sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas, yeah. Which I also love.
But again, when it first came out, that Pret sandwich was very good, but I feel like it's gone downhill over the years.
Yeah, but again, it's nostalgia. It reminds me of that Christmas meal, so I still love it.
Is that one of the things that it's best to have it as a street food, or is it something that you could also get in a nice restaurant or you have at someone's house?
I mean, it's one of those things. It's like all street food has been glamorized, so you do get it in restaurants. You get it in restaurants here. You get
it
in restaurants there.
But it's best to get it on the
street. You go to Wembley, there are places that do it. Still, the pav is never as good as Bombay.
Okay, where's the best place that you found in London?
What's it called? I forget the name. There is a place in Wembley that does it. It's just off the main strip, Shri Krishna. I'll find out.
When I was reading about your story, it sort of seemed in a way like you're almost an oxymoron, because you've described yourself as a very risk-averse lawyer, but then you're also very brave and entrepreneurial. How do you think those two things marry together?
I've learned to listen to my gut a lot more. Mm. And I think, you know, for those of you, hopefully we'll have that side dish episode where I'll talk about one of my dinner party guests, and I've learned a lot from him, so I'll leave you in suspense.
Okay. We love a teaser.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But do you think as you've gone along, you've embraced risk more? And do you think you have?
100%, but I think it's still calculated risk.
Okay.
It's a bit like, you know, getting into food, which was a huge risk, you know, having left a very successful career, or at least potentially successful career, behind. But you've got to do it for the right reasons. You've got to do it with your eyes wide open. And I still won't take speculative risks. I always say I work for my luck.
Okay.
I'm very unlucky. So I literally, the day I invested in a little bit of Bitcoin, it was only a few hundred quid, the whole market came crashing down. So I'm sorry if I brought your investments down.
That was your fault.
That was my fault. The day I got my British passport, the gate stopped working. So that's how unlucky I can be. No, honestly.
Would you describe yourself as an unlucky person?
No, not at all. But I just think free luck is not something I get. I work very hard for my luck. And I think when you are lucky, you should make the most of it and benefit as many people around you as possible.
Yeah. I like that.
So that's something that, you know, I think people often dwell on what they've been unlucky about, but I feel in life it has a way of balancing out. You might work really hard for something and not get somewhere.
Yeah.
And then by dwelling on that, you might gloss over something that came sort of pretty easy. But
yeah,
if you focus on that and then you sort of maximize and amplify it and do as much good as you can. It's like for me, feeding people, you know, maybe having created this amazing platform with Hoppers, maybe, you know, talking about Indian food is great. And I think I want to try and sort of do as much good as out of it as I can, whether it's for my team, whether it's for guests who come in, I connect it back to a sort of heritage, or cook my recipes off Instagram at home and, you know, actually answer them, or build schools in Sri Lanka, which is something we started doing recently.
I think luck is also down to perspective, isn't it? Like, you can take the same situation and think you're very lucky, and then if you're a very negative person, but it's sort of how you think.
I mean, but that said, there are some people who are just damn lucky.
Well, I know there are.
There are some people who just look at them like, where the hell?
But I wonder if
I guess if you analyze their entire lives, it balances out somewhere. But, you know, I think it's better to just look at your own.
We're on to the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
This is not going to be a sexy answer, but at the moment, boiled eggs.
Boiled
eggs and rajma chawal. So rajma chawal is sort of, it's a very simple kidney bean stew with plain, simple rice, green chilies, cucumbers, tomato on the side. Which is, I mean, apart from all the fancy cooking, this is more the sort of recurring themes. We have my wife and I, when we, you know, just want to sit in front of the telly in each other's company and not have to bother about cooking, we've got a stash of these, you know, made for two in the freezer, which I've bulk cooked, batch cooked and kept. And it's comfort food at its purest. Rajma chawal.
Do you think when opening a restaurant now, do you think the most important thing is passion?
I think when doing anything, passion is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Unless you're in a very structured job, right?
Be really passionate.
But even then to get to the pinnacles of, you know, today when I look back at my cohort of, you know, fellow lawyers, it's only the people who we knew were secretly, even if they'd mourned just to be part of the gang, it's the ones who were genuinely passionate about it in this weird sort of sadomasochistic way. It's only those people who've like risen to the top.
Yeah.
Most have fallen by the wayside. But the good thing is, in, you know, professions, in a lot of those sort of conventional professions, whether it's law, banking, accountancy, or things like that, or even medicine to an extent, but I think medicine needs a lot more passion. But I think in some of those conventional sort of corporate professions, you could get away just doing 60% and not feeling fully fulfilled.
Yeah.
But I always say that's it's good to have people like that, because otherwise, if everyone goes and starts creating things, who's going to consume?
Well, yeah.
So, yeah, yeah. So we need everyone. We need people with, you know, deep pockets and boredom.
Yeah.
People who want to be fed as opposed to cook. Mm. So yeah. It's nice. Nice.
It's very true.
Different
and everybody's different.
Exactly.
The people of Sri Lanka have had a very difficult few years, and Hoppers have been doing the most amazing things to give back. You've been building schools and providing meals to children. I imagine you have a lot of emotions tied to the country, not only from everything that they're going through, but everything that they've given to you in a way.
I think, you know, for me, it's I look at it less as giving back, and I just look at it as full circle. It's like completing the loop.
Yeah.
I feel I would never have found my identity if it wasn't for Sri Lanka. I already said I've got more friends there than anywhere else. And, you know, the way I've been received, loved, cheered on has been incredible. So we were on holiday early 22 and in Sri Lanka at a lovely time with my boys and wife, and then came back. And soon after that, almost a month after that, they had this horrible political sort of uprising that then led to obviously social impact and massive, had a horrible economic and social impact. And having grown up in a country where I saw poverty very closely, the one thing I sort of loved about Sri Lanka is that you didn't have that poverty. There was a lot more. There was a very good base quality of life.
Mm.
You could almost see that in the years to come, that poverty will be something that becomes real with inflation at 400% and stuff. It was nuts. So we came back and, you know, everyone is posting things on social media saying, look, our hearts are out for you. Like, you know, sitting here and not doing much. And I said, let's actually do something fun. Let's do something that makes an impact. Let's do something that actually creates a little, you know, change on the ground. And we had done various charities in the past, but this time something in me said, like, we need to just do a proper project. And again, somehow things aligned, and I ended up within 3 days of thinking about this and talking to people about it, I ended up meeting the gentleman who happened to be on holiday. He's got a very large group of conglomerates, him and his family. But within that, they've got an amazing outreach foundation, which does all their CSR. Within that, they've got three charities. And then we basically agreed to plug into one of the charities, which works with preschools. So, and you know, sort of education and food. Less food, but more education. So they plug into these preschools. They have about 67, 66 or 67 at last count.
Wow.
And for me, that made a big difference. I was very close to home because my kids were in preschool at that point, and food was something so important. Education is the biggest gift you can give anyone.
Mm.
And a lot of these kids had stopped going to school because they were the children of daily wage earners who just lost their jobs overnight. And, you know, you could see that knock-on effect happening. But long story short, we said we want to support with food. We want to support these kids with ration packs. We chose 15 schools from 6 districts so that there's no bias as to ethnicity as well, because you've got different ethnicities in different regions. So initially in 22, we did 15 schools, 6 districts, about 397 families.
Wow.
We fed from sort of June to the end of the year. These 20 kilo bags, we even went there later on in the year and distributed some of them. And it was amazing seeing the impact. So every penny that we raised here was going there. And come 23, we said, look, we don't want reliance on this, because eventually, you know, they were getting out of that horrible, the eye of the storm, and things were getting slightly better. And then we said, okay, we've got excess funds. We will still continue doing this, but we'd rather now pick 1,000 or I think it's 1,097 families who are the worst off across the entire network. So instead of going to 3 schools, now we have these families, maybe it's grown to like 1,300 families. And give them protein-rich packs.
Mm.
So give them things like dried fish, coconut milk powder, certain protein biscuits. So smaller packs, but more impact.
Mm.
And then with the excess funds, we decided, let's build schools now. I was in Sri Lanka about a month ago, and we laid foundation for a second school. And next week, or actually beginning of March, we are laying foundation for a third.
Wow.
So hopefully by the end of 24, we'll have 4 schools. And in a dream world, I'd like to build 2 schools a year after that.
Be so proud.
Again, like I said earlier, you know, like I've been lucky to have this platform, and all we're doing is, you know, doing what we love doing, cooking dishes, giving some of the money to charity. I do events and I give money to charity. On all my book sales to the restaurant, there's money going to charity. Plus our guests are kind enough to donate a pound on every bill, which is optional, but most of them do it. And that's obviously the biggest feeder, but I want to put my money where my mouth is. So there are various sources. And these are just things I love doing. So if we can do this much, you know, make this impact back there, I don't think you need credit for it. The only reason I talk about it is because people are often nervous to send money to these places because they don't know where it goes. But this is a great route to doing it. We've made sure it's 100% transparent, leak-free.
Yeah.
So please talk to us. Yeah.
Incredible. Let's talk about the sixth Desert Island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
At my house or someone else's house?
Do you get to request if you're at someone else's house?
Well, I don't get invited much. And I know a lot of your chefs have said this, but it's one of those sort of hazards of the profession, you know. You invite people. My wife keeps saying you overwhelm them, that you'll never be invited. And it's true. So anytime we meet friends who actually invite us back, those are friends for life. We make sure
we invest
a lot in them. we have a few of those. And they're not even in the trade, but they cook really, really well.
Oh, yeah.
And I look forward to it.
So what do you serve if you're overwhelming these people? What are you giving them?
I've kind of decided... No, so to avoid the overwhelming people now, I've gone to sort of... There are two go-tos I have.
I want to be overwhelmed when I go to a dinner party. I think that's a good thing.
So then, so we used to have this format earlier before the kids where we'd have a Sunday afternoon. It was this sort of linner party. So lunch and dinner. 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was crazy. I would come back from Hoppeso. We only had one then. This is back in 2016 and 17. I still miss those parties. Come back at like midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning after the night cleaner's done. Later, 1:30 in the morning. Wife would go to bed. I would go shower, get into track pants, and then go off to the Turkish store. Same one I went to on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And then buy my groceries. I made a menu in my head. For me, that was unwinding and de-stress at the end of a week. I'd then come home and cook till 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Then I'd go to bed and wake up at 11:30, 12. Yeah. I don't sleep much.
Yeah, see, good luck doing that with children.
And no, there's no way we're doing that now. But then we'd have guests over by 3. So it was a dream because they'd come over at 3 and then they'd leave at midnight. They'd leave at sort of 7, 8 in the evening.
So nice.
And you're not hungry after that. You've cleared up. 8 o'clock, you're in your couch and you're like, wow, done for the weekend. Don't have to think about dinner right now. And those were great. And those were sort of almost sort of showing off and going off and cooking very fancy things. And those are the ones that overwhelm people.
Yeah.
Now it's, my go-tos are either pizza. I love cooking pizza at home because it's a bit like a barbecue. I've got a couple of pizza ovens kicking about at home.
That's a very cool sentence. A couple of pizzas.
Yeah, I know. I work with one company
okay.
and they're great. But I love pizza. I'm obsessed with it. It's so simple, but still so versatile.
Yeah. What's your go-to topping?
Pizza needs to be very simple. 3 things, if that. Normally a margarita
is
the best way to go, but green chilies and mushrooms, or red chilies, green chilies, mushrooms are my only toppings. I hate meat on pizzas. I don't like anything that sort of overcomplicates the clean flavors of cheese, tomato, and good bread.
So
good bread is the most important
thing. Hopefully you'll agree that pineapple is just wrong.
Oh, no,
wrong.
No. Yeah, it's not even very close to pizza.
No,
but for me, pizza is a great one because it's a bit like a barbecue. You sort of fiddle around and often there are kids involved. So they always come and you become favorite uncle and stuff for that, which is great fun. I love cooking with kids. But the other one is if we're doing an adults only sort of evening dinner party, it's biryani.
Mm.
So again, one pot, you know what a biryani is, sort of layered meat and rice. It's... All the effort goes into the one pot. It is the dream and it's the ultimate one pot meal. Maybe a dal on the side, definitely a salad and a raita. And, you know, you open it on the table. Oh. It stays warm. You keep it in the oven while your guests are there so you can actually enjoy with them. Sit down. If I really want to go all out, I might light a barbecue, do some kebabs before that. But again, you're sort of getting to the territory of feeding people too much. And
do you have a go-to pudding?
Ice cream. I love ice cream.
Yeah.
It's still one of those, it's so simple to make. And I'll tell you a trick. I was like, you can buy store-bought custard. Just mix it. You get good store-bought custard.
Yeah.
Mix it with some fruit puree, a little bit of gelatin if you want.
Yeah.
So it's very, very quick. You don't even have to make your custard base. But I do make my custard base.
Yeah, that is a good tip.
And then you either have one of those freezer bowls if you've got space in the freezer. I'm lucky enough to have one of those sort of electronic ones. So you don't even need to prepare for that. But I find ice cream always blows people away and it's so tasty. You can keep leftovers. I eat ice cream all the time.
On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
So I learned a lot of my cooking and I guess learned how to feed, eat and enjoy eating with a man who we call Tatun. He was grand uncle. So he was a bachelor for life and he would come home. So I didn't have a paternal grandfather. He passed away before I was born. So this man was almost, he played that role. But you could never ask him to come home. He'd never, you know, there was no requesting him to turn up. He would just turn up if he wanted to. But I remember the meals that he would cook for us were always spectacular. He'd come with a bag of South Indian ingredients that you wouldn't normally find in stores. So he'd go to the local wet market, get some really interesting vegetables and spices. And he would cook the best meals. And I think shortly before he passed away, he gave me his little South Indian cookbook, which is like a little paperback, which, you know, was probably some home cook who wrote it years ago. But for me, that is my most treasured possession, because he would only bring that one book. He had two, actually. I don't know where the second part is. He had part one, part two. It was called Cook and See, which I bet translates to something different. But it's an English book, Cook and See. And he'd bring that book along with these vegetables and he'd actually follow the recipes.
Wow. That's
It's got about 200 recipes in this 100-page softback book. But for me, that's just that if I was to lose all my books, I'd still hold on to that one.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible.
Just for sentimental value.
We're on to the final seventh desert island dish. Yeah. What is the last dish you'd choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
I think it would be sort of Peking duck.
Ooh.
Done in all its glory.
Yes.
Absolutely love good Peking duck. And I remember when we opened Hoppers Soho, before we got home at that 1:30 in the morning, then went off and cooked, we'd often, I think about four times a week, I'd be in Chinatown eating duck in different forms, whether it was sort of that the British aromatic, crispy duck. But I like the traditional Peking duck. Mm. And that's another dish we do every year at Christmas. There's a meal I always do at home. I get a goose and I try and cook a goose in that Peking duck style, where the skin is served separately with pancakes and then you use the meat and stir fry it, and then you stir fry a little bit of the rice. So,
is it easy to cook at home?
Oh, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. But
once a year.
That's once a year. And every year, no matter how well I do, I'll always change it up and like make it hard for myself the following year.
And do you have a sweet tooth? Are you going to have
massive sweet tooth?
Are you going to have a pudding before you go to the island?
Pudding needs to have chocolate, apart from sort of nice fruit ice creams and stuff like that. But eventually, sort of, even if I go off and, you know, eat a dessert with tons of nice fruit and a massive sweet tooth, I'd still like to end on chocolate.
Okay. What's your go-to chocolate?
I think a Ben & Jerry's chocolate fudge brownie. Very simple, but that's my guilty pleasure on the sofa.
Perfect.
Love any ice cream with mix-ins.
Yeah,
but, you know, a good chocolate tart. Give me any chocolate in any form.
Maybe like
on the darker
a
side.
Chocolate buffet.
Yes, sweet. Chocolate buffet is perfect.
Yeah. That's what we'll do.
So where I sort of, I avoid two courses, we'll just put those two, club those together as dessert.
And with that, we're going to send you off to the desert island. Thank you so
much. As long as
it's
sun, I'm very happy to go anywhere. Want to ditch that umbrella?
Yeah, we'll try and arrange that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
So there we have it. Another delicious day of desert island dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're listening. It really does make a difference and helps others to find the show and means that I can keep bringing it to you each week. If you don't already, then do come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, and you can sign up for the newsletter and find a whole host of different recipes at desertislanddishes.co. Thank you again to HG Walter, our sponsor for this month of Desert Island Dishes, and thank you so much for listening. Bye.